Welcome. Welcome to the session on U.S. Counterterrorism policy, 6 months into the new Trump administration. My colleague, Charles Lister, is an MEI senior fellow, conceived of this panel in the context of MEI's project on extremism and counterterrorism, a project funded by the Carnegie Corporation in New York. It looks at drivers of radicalization and extremism, the growth and spread of terrorism organizations, and the policies to counter them. Today's event will be recorded and can be followed later by video. We were going to be live streaming it, but the live stream service is down, so I apologize for that. We ask you to silence your mobile devices, but we do encourage tweeting. Use the hashtag MEI event if you are to do so. To discuss today's topic, we have a distinguished panel. They are complete and, I would say, illustrious bios in the handout, so I won't go into details there. My introductions will be brief so that we can hear from our panelists. To my right is Mr. Brett McGurk. He's the Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIS in the U.S. in the U.S. Department of State. He leads the Global Coalition of 72 members and helps coordinate all aspects of U.S. policy related to the destruction of ISIS. And we're very grateful, Brett, that you took time out from your very busy schedule to be with us today. Joshua Geltzer, to his right, is a fellow at New America's International Security Program, was part of the Obama administration's counterterrorism team. Jennifer Caffarella, to my exact left, is a fellow at the Institute of the Study of War and works meticulously on the situation in Syria and the Levant in general. Matt Levitt is a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and director of WINIP's program on counterterrorism and intelligence. And I think you also just produced a report on countering violent extremism, a CVE report. There you go. Wave it about. And, of course, Charles Lister, who's MEI's resident senior fellow, and as I mentioned, heads our extremism and counterterrorism project. We'll have a few questions addressed to the panelists, and they will make their remarks. I will engage them in a bit of conversation, and then we will go to the audience for an audience Q&A, and we will end promptly at 1:30. Brett, let's start with you. You cover the whole Iraq-Syria gamut. The liberation of Mosul happened recently, the campaign in Raqqa is going according to schedule, or even maybe a bit ahead of schedule. What can you tell us about the situations there, both in Mosul and Raqqa, and plans beyond Mosul and Raqqa in terms of the hard fight against ISIS? In a second round, maybe we'll look at issues of stabilization and sort of post-fight issues. So, Brett, your thoughts, please.
Okay. Is this... Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the interest of time, I think what I'll do is give a kind of macro status report of the fight against ISIS. I'll focus on ISIS, although I know the panel discussion might be a little broader. I'll zoom in a little bit on Iraq and Syria to answer your question, and also a little kind of what we're doing beyond those theaters. So let me focus on Iraq and Syria. Why Iraq and Syria? It is the ISIS so-called phony caliphate that they declared in 2014. If you travel around the world to capitals, you ask, why have so many of your young people joined and traveled to Syria? And 40,000 foreign fighters traveled to Syria in 2013, 14, 15, 16. Just an unprecedented and kind of catastrophic situation in terms of a CT threat. They can't get in now. Let me just say, they cannot get into Syria now. Very difficult for them to get into Syria now. And foreign fighters who did get in are still there. They will die in Iraq and Syria. We're very committed to that. So let me give a kind of an update on where we are. Overall in this campaign since 2014, we have cleared, and when I say we, by with and through working with local forces, cleared 70,000 square kilometers that used to be controlled by ISIS. 5 million people who were living under ISIS are no longer living under ISIS. They have been freed. Most significantly, all of this territory that coalition-enabled forces have cleared, all of it has held. This is not a situation in which we go in, clear an area, and then ISIS or the enemy comes back. It is all held. And part of that is because before we launch any military operation, we do extensive months of work at the local level to plan what we call stabilization for what comes after the military campaign. Stabilization is kind of a pioneering effort for how to do these things. It's not nation building. It's not trying to pick local winners and losers. It is the basic elements to get people to their homes after the battle. And it's unglamorous work, but it is water, electricity, rubble removal, clearing IEDs. And our coalition, Global Coalition, has helped throughout this process of raising the funds and making sure these things can work. So in Iraq, we have now helped the Iraqis return. 2 million Iraqis have returned to their homes in areas that used to be controlled by ISIS. That is a totally unprecedented rate of returns of a civilian population in a post-conflict environment, and that's something that we very much want to make sure continues. Zoom in very briefly on Iraq. As you mentioned, Mosul now, the Battle of Mosul is finished. The last 3 weeks of the battle in the Old City, you've probably seen the pictures of the Old City. That is not reflective of Mosul writ large, but that was one of the most intense urban combat situations we've seen since World War II. We had hundreds of foreign fighters, our advisors and Iraqi forces picking up on the radios, ISIS speaking Dutch, Russian, Chinese, French, and non-Iraqi dialect Arabic. Hundreds of foreign fighters barricaded with a civilian population, wearing suicide vests and using the civilian population as human shields. One of the most horrific military urban combat situations we've seen in a long time, and we give the Iraqi security forces a tremendous credit for what they have done. Future operations in Iraq, ISIS still controls some pockets. They control the town of Tal Afar west of Mosul. They control the town of Hawija and the district around Hawija south of Kirkuk. They control some areas in western Anbar province and the border. The Iraqi security forces, at the time of choosing of the Iraqi government, will launch military operations to finish those three areas. That means resecuring sovereign control of the Iraqi border with legitimate Iraqi security forces, clearing Tal Afar and Hawija. That will be done when the Iraqi government decides to launch those operations. We will support them, and they will succeed. As a coalition, we have trained now 100,000 members of the Iraqi security forces, and we're quite proud to say that the units we have trained have never lost a battle. Not only have they never lost a battle, these are very high casualty conflicts. And despite some units suffering very high numbers of casualties in urban conflict, they have never stopped to advance and they have never lost a battle. Just briefly on Iraq, kind of beyond ISIS, it's just, I think it's worth reflecting. There's some things going on that often aren't picked up. A very historic opening between Iraq and Saudi Arabia is underway. This is something that obviously we encourage, but it was really brokered between the Iraqi government and the government of Saudi Arabia. And this is really quite significant. We're talking now about opening border crossings that have been closed since 1990. We're also talking about a very significant reconstruction project opening the border crossing with Jordan. That's a $1 billion a month commerce route. Also, things that were not happening and even contemplated are now starting to move. If you follow Iraq closely, their oil production has reached all-time highs, and they're in very close talks with private sector industry and with Kuwait about capturing flared gas and exporting to Kuwait. These are kind of big things that are happening in Iraq that often aren't picked up. Let me zoom in briefly on Syria. I've made three trips to Syria this year. Each time you go, you see a situation that is dramatically different than the time you were there in the past. What is happening now in Syria, particularly as we're underway in the Raqqa campaign, is a force, the Syrian Democratic Forces, is now a force of about 25,000 Sunni Arab fighters, about 25,000 Kurdish fighters. The Sunni Arab component of this force continues to grow and to grow in numbers even beyond what we had initially anticipated. All of our training classes now are full, and as we move south and defeat ISIS, the numbers of recruits coming into this force continues to swell. It really is a Satwa-like situation happening on the ground, and you can see it if you go with your own eyes in terms of thousands of Sunni Arab fighters joining this force to go fight and liberate their hometowns. Raqqa is now about 40% finished. That does not mean that Raqqa started on June 6th. This will take a long time. This will take a long time. It is very painstaking, not just block by block, but room by room work through these high-rise buildings in Raqqa. And again, we give the force we're working with tremendous credit. We're moving pretty close now to linking up the east and west axis of this advance, which will be a very significant development. Why is Raqqa important? Raqqa was it was really an entrepot of terrorism. It was where major attacks were planned against Brussels, Paris, Istanbul, major attacks being planned against many of our partners, major planning of the types of terrorist attacks, 9/11 type events that they wanted to pull off. That was all happening in Raqqa, and not a very long, it wasn't a very long time ago. So getting ISIS out of Raqqa is quite critical. One other key data point that's happening in Syria. As we move against ISIS, the population that was living under ISIS, the IDP flow out of these areas are all flowing, nearly 100% of them now, are flowing into the areas controlled by the Syrian Democratic Forces. And we, of course, are doing all we can to make sure that this population receives aid. We track the numbers every single day. There's about 275,000 now. And for the most part, they are now all receiving aid. And what we are being told by all of these folks is that they want to go home. And as areas are cleared and as areas are cleared of landmines, they do go home. And a number of these people who are fleeing are also joining the ranks of the force that we're working with. After Raqqa, of course, a little bit to the east, the Khabar River Valley and the Middle Euphrates Valley, ISIS still retains some sanctuary there. Make no mistake, we will get them out of there, but I'm not going to preview exactly how, but that will happen. I want to touch very quickly, because it's a big issue in Syria, on deconfliction. We call it deconfliction with Russia. That is a necessity as forces converge in certain areas, and those deconfliction channels are working quite well. U.S. forces shot down a Syrian plane in the middle of June, and actually after that event, our deconfliction channels with the Russians actually picked up steam. We have a number of arrangements now with Russia that are holding and actually helping us to accelerate the defeat of ISIS. We also, of course, President Putin and President Trump in Hamburg finalized an arrangement in southwest Syria for a ceasefire arrangement in southwest Syria. We're 2.5 weeks into that ceasefire. The fighting has almost completely stopped. We're actually now seeing signs of people returning from Jordan to their homes in the southwest. That's just beginning, but very promising. What is different about that ceasefire than other ceasefires that we have tried is that it is based upon a very months of negotiations, a very painstaking negotiation with what we call a line of contact, kind of block by block through Daraa City, which is the main city down there, and throughout the entire southwest, so that everybody knows exactly where they should be and where they can't be. And that what that makes this ceasefire quite different. I can get into issues beyond Syria in the back and forth, from foreign fighters to counter-finance to counter-messaging, what our coalition is doing. We now have built the largest coalition of its kind in history, 73 members, 69 countries, plus Interpol, the Arab League, NATO, and the EU. We just added 4 new African countries just last week in a meeting we had at the State Department. And let me finally say something very important, because I want to get it on the table up front, because we're often asked what's different under President Trump than under President Obama. And we have made some pretty significant changes, and I'll just put them on the table just up front. So really, I think four key changes. Number one, this is in the counter-ISIS campaign. President Trump made very clear priorities to defeat ISIS, and he wants to accelerate the campaign. And we've done four things. Number one, he delegated tactical authority, really, in the first week of the administration to the lowest possible level. And delegating tactical authority does not mean delegating big strategic questions, such as we faced a question, the force that would ultimately liberate Raqqa. That was a decision that went to the president, and he made that decision. It actually wasn't a very hard decision, given the options that we faced. But delegating tactical authority to the lowest level has made a key difference. And I'll just give one anecdote. I was in Syria in March, and I was with General Townsend, who's our overall commander in Iraq and Syria, who's done an incredible job under very difficult circumstances. And we were meeting with kind of the local forces that we're working with, and they sensed an opportunity to launch what was a fairly audacious military maneuver across about 8 kilometers of water. And they wanted helicopter airlift. They thought they could catch ISIS by surprise, capture the town of Topka, the dam of Topka, and the airport of Topka, and do it fairly rapidly, which would really set the conditions for Raqqa. It was high risk. It was audacious. But because Steve, General Townsend, had that authority, he was able to approve it almost immediately, and within 4 days, we were able to launch that operation, catch ISIS by surprise, and it was a major success. And the reason we're 40% through Raqqa now is because we seized that opportunity. So that quick, rapid-turn decision-making makes a difference. Second, you've probably heard General Mattis talk about this, but we've adopted it's a campaign of annihilation, and that means before we really launch a massive operation against ISIS, we do the political work, we do the stabilization work, and the humanitarian work. But it is a surround, constrict, and annihilate strategy. That particularly means for the foreign fighters. We do not want any foreign fighters getting out of Iraq and Syria, and we're very focused on that. Number three, a real intensified outreach to the coalition and burden sharing. This is not our fight alone. This is a global campaign. And very early on in the administration, Secretary Tillerson asked, again, all 70, at the time it was about 69 members of the coalition, to come to Washington, focus on the post-Mosul phase and the stabilization phase, and we raised about $2 billion in that session. And for every dollar the U.S. is spending on stabilization humanitarian programs, we have about $3 from the coalition, and we're working to grow that ratio here over the coming months. So the coalition is a key element of this overall campaign, and the burden sharing is something that is quite critical and central to the overall effort. Just fourth, the global effects. We're working, and we were of course doing this before, but we're working to accelerate wherever we can to sever the connections entirely between the ISIS core in Iraq and Syria and its so-called affiliates around the world. We have shut down critical financial nodes. We have done a lot to actually really cut off those connections between ISIS Central in Iraq and Syria and the affiliates. And what we're finding is that these affiliates are really dependent upon, whether from the Sinai to other areas, really dependent on funding from Central Syria. And we've really worked to sever those networks, and that's happening. So overall, I think if you look at the overall record of territory seized, they haven't taken back a single speck of territory that we've retaken. The population returning to their homes. These are nearly all Sunni Arabs returning to their homes. And the forces that we're working with in terms of their growth, their sophistication, and particularly recruiting locals into their ranks, this is very much a policy that is on track. I would just say it is very different. Sometimes it can be frustrating to work by with and through partners. It means that we, the U.S. government, is not entirely in control of events on the ground. Of course, we weren't entirely in control of events on the ground when we had a very different model. But I just want to put some data points out there for the benefit of discussion, then I'll stop there. If you compare the surge in Iraq in 2007, and I worked in the White House very closely with President Bush, many, I think, in this room, on that very important policy, which very much supported at the time. That was a critical decision that was necessary. But if you look at the costs, it was about 160,000 troops in Iraq at the time, spending $304 million a day. It's about $111 billion a year. And most importantly, in 2007 alone, and I remember this quite vividly because we used to write a three-page report to the president every single night, and the first page he read every night was the casualty count. And in 2007, 904 Americans were killed in action, fighting very bravely in Iraq. If you look at what we're doing now, we have cleared far more territory than back then. ISIS is an outgrowth of AQI, but fueled by 40,000 foreign fighters from around the world, which makes it very different than what we faced, and in many senses more lethal than what we faced back then. All the territories held, as I mentioned. Depending on who's counting on any given day, it's about $11 to $13 million a day, about $3 billion a year compared with $111 billion a year. And I think, you know, most importantly, I visited Walter Reed a couple months ago, and there were two kind of brave heroes who were recovering from their wounds and just very different than what we did in 2007. So far in this campaign, two Americans have been killed in Syria and five Americans have been killed in Iraq, mostly from IEDs. I think this model, by, with, and through, we are pioneering how to do this. It is different. It's working. It's sustainable. And sustainable is key because this will be a long-term effort. And I think it's the right model. And I think the changes that President Trump has made in terms of the delegation has made it work more effectively, more efficiently, very importantly. We are devastating this enemy. And we are not going to stop until we take away all of his physical space. They will remain a cellular terrorist network. We understand that. They will try to pop up in other parts of the world. That's why we have a global coalition. We cannot let the pressure off. We cannot take our boot off the throat of this enemy, not just over the next year, but really over the next 10 years. This is something that we will be engaged in for a very long time, but we have to do it in a sustainable way that helps protect, most importantly, our homelands. So I spoke a little longer than I wanted to, but that's kind of a broad breadth overview, and then we can talk about some of the details in the discussion.
Thank you very much, Brett, and there'll be more questions in the Q&A, but thank you for that presentation. Let me turn to you, Josh. You were in the Obama administration. A lot of these policies obviously began under the Obama administration when ISIS first emerged or re-emerged. From what you've heard from Brett and what you've been following, working on your new position, but also previously, where do you see continuity? Where do you see change? Are the conditions different, or are the policies, as Brett was saying, indeed different?
Let me just say first a word of thanks for including me in this great discussion with great folks, and in particular, it is very good to see Brett again. Some in this room may appreciate, but many in the public may not fully appreciate what a tireless and effective part of the counter-ISIS campaign Brett has been, and we are all lucky to have you continuing to do very hard, very good work. So it is good to see you again. And I'll keep this brief, but to offer just a couple of really big picture framing thoughts. The campaign that Brett so effectively laid out, I think, has a lot of signs of continuity, just as he suggested. You look at the big sweep of it, the arc of it, the clearing and holding, very important, the holding of territory once ISIS has been cleared from it, the success in Mosul, the soon-to-be, as hard a slog as it is, soon-to-be success in Raqqa, the idea that there's going to be a push down to the Euphrates River Valley. This is all, it's a good news story, and it's a story with, I think, a lot of continuity to it. It's the campaign, roughly as conceived at one point and methodically executed with, as always, unexpected elements along the way, and always a desire for it to go faster because safe haven in the hands of terrorists is itself a threat at any given time. But there's a lot of continuity to that story. One thing that strikes me as a new element to the story is some of the encounters between the United States and actors other than ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria in particular. So we have in the past months encounters with the regime, whether it's the strike against the airfield or interactions with Syrian planes and pilots. We have reports of Iranian UAVs and it's not clear to me, and I'm not sure there needs to be a resolution one way or the other, whether this is in fact a policy shift or whether this is itself part of a story in which as different actors move in a very complicated landscape on the ground and in the air, they were almost inevitably going to bump up against each other in new and interesting ways. But whatever the drivers of these new encounters, it adds to the complexity of the difficulty of doing counterterrorism, the difficulty of Syria and Iraq, and the difficulty of doing counterterrorism in Syria and Iraq, when all these actors are really close together and having these sorts of encounters. That strikes me as new, and that I wanted to put that on the table as something that may merit some further discussion. One other piece to keep on the table is Al-Qaeda in Syria itself. This has been a concern to many of us who worked on the issue in government and many folks outside government for a while now, and even this past week, at least in the public reports, there seem to be indications that Al-Qaeda in Syria is, as it has been relatively tenacious in trying to do, using opportunities to seize additional safe haven, to integrate itself into parts of the local population, parts of other forces, bumping into other forces as well, but to keep focus on Al-Qaeda's largest manifestation globally right now and the threat it poses as it remains or even increases the land it at least tries to control and its insinuation into the lifeblood, politics, even society of parts of Syria. That's another item that I wanted to at least put on the table because it is a story with both continuity as a concern and I think some developments in recent months too.
Thank you, Joshua. Maybe that's a good lead to Jennifer looking at the strategic picture that U.S. counterterrorism policy is working within, maybe a bit longer term. That brings in sort of what is ISIS going to be after this, you know, these few months or maybe in 2018. Where will AQ be? And the large Iranian presence in Iran, which the U.S. has bumped up against here and there, but it's still a very major presence throughout Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. How does that factor into long-term counterterrorism policy?
Sure. Thank you. I would say, just to clarify at the outset, the bumping into the Iranians, so to speak, on this battlefield has included the Iranians and their proxies, or through their proxies, rather, positioning themselves, of course, to threaten U.S. forces and U.S. partnered forces on the ground. So some of the strikes against the Syrian regime plane, for example, and the Iranian UAV were actually force protection strikes in defense of American troops and partners on the ground. So I think that's important to clarify up front. I would zoom back to echo the discussion of al-Qaeda in Syria and bring it to the strategic level. The United States went to war in 2001 because we were attacked. And we haven't won that war. We're still in Afghanistan, obviously. The discussion of the status quo in Afghanistan is actually one of stalemate at best. Al-Qaeda is actually returning, and we see evidence of that, among other things, by targeted U.S. strikes against key al-Qaeda leaders and attack planners back in Afghanistan. ISIS is attempting to grow an affiliate there, so that certainly is an enduring challenge to American national security, if not a growing one. Meanwhile, we have damaged, but we're far from destroying ISIS in Iraq and Syria. We have done so at extraordinary human cost, which the brunt of which is, of course, the fault and the intent of the ISIS organization. But I think it's important to note that this time around, this enemy has been even more effective in Iraq and Syria than its predecessor was. The level of destruction of Mosul that was forced by ISIS and the way that ISIS has defended is immense. And this is our second time around. And while I am heartened to hear that we may actually have follow-on operations on the Syrian side of the border in the Euphrates River Valley, I certainly hope that those operations do not occur in coordination with the Russians and the pro-regime coalition more broadly, because my concern is that while we are very good at damaging this enemy, and we are very good at killing ISIS fighters and actually al-Qaeda fighters, though we're not really doing that on the Syrian side of the border, we're less good actually at securing the peace. And this time around, the conditions favor the insurgents in both Iraq and Syria. While IDPs are returning to their homes in Iraq, which is important, and hopefully will return to their homes in Raqqa, many of those homes are destroyed. And it remains to be seen, actually, whether those populations will believe in the central Iraqi government. I think it's too soon to tell. There will be elections, and that will be an indicator. But the sources of grievances on the Iraqi side of the border endure or have grown. Iranian presence in Iraq is manifold. It's strengthening, actually, and that does cause grievances. The Iranian-backed elements of the popular mobilization may be the smallest element of the popular mobilization, and I don't contest the assessment that many elements of that popular mobilization that responded to Sistani's fatwa are positive and have made important gains. But the Iranian elements are, again, preparing to win the peace, or at least to contest the peace. And so I do think that there are still a lot of drivers of instability in this region that could make our important gains against ISIS thus far temporary. And I would remind us all that the United States withdrew from Iraq in 2011, and by 2014, Iraq's second largest city had already fallen. That's actually not a very long time frame, considering that we have been at war in Afghanistan, as I mentioned, since 2014. So I think the scale of the problem actually is important to keep in mind, despite the tactical successes that we have achieved in Iraq and Syria. The final thing I will say is that we continue to underestimate al-Qaeda. And I think part of the problem writ large with America's counterterrorism strategy is that we continue to call these guys terrorists, which they are. However, their goals are not just to kill Americans. Actually, ISIS and al-Qaeda are both pursuing the destruction of the existing state system and the destruction of the Western way of life. Terrorism is only one of the tactics at their disposal, and it's not actually even the most resource-intensive component of their organization. So while al-Qaeda in Syria is not currently actively attacking abroad, they have built an army that has consolidated control in Idlib and is preparing to do the same underneath the U.S.-Russian ceasefire deal in Deraa to expand that model for first destroying the moderate opposition and then beginning to instill al-Qaeda's governance to transform the population over time. This is a very long war. We have not won it yet, and I think it's important to remember that these tactical successes, while important, can be temporary if we do not set the adequate conditions, which is a much more than a military requirement. I think the Iranian presence on this battlefield has not received enough attention, so thank you for asking that question. I will defer to my Iranian expert colleagues on that one. I know Matt is prepared to talk about that, but I think it's important to note that while we have remained focused on ISIS, other key players in the region have prepared for what comes next. The Iranians certainly have a malign campaign in the region, and they intend, among other things, to expel the United States and ensure that the U.S. cannot return. Not in a way that favors American interests, actually, in a way that will ensure that jihadis have both cause and likely opportunity to retain, if not expand, their safe havens in that region. And with there, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for those very insightful comments. Matt, let's turn to you. She drafted you to talk about a little bit about Iran. Please do, but also you have extensive experience in the counter-finance side of terrorists and also the CVE aspect, the radicalization trends and so on. And maybe if you can comment as to whether in any of your studies one sees a bit of a change in Arab Sunni public opinion, whether it's in Iraq or Syria. Maybe initially there was some, you know, more tolerance of the radicalization. Is that the same or is it less? Any trend lines there? So your thoughts, Matt, please.
So first of all, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, especially with this distinguished panel. I should be able to cover all things CVE, CFT, counterterror finance, and Iran in about an hour and a half.
Good. You have 3 minutes.
3 minutes is
no,
just fine.
More than 3 minutes.
I'm actually going to leave the Iran thing for the questions and answers, and I certainly hope it comes up because it's a huge issue. At the end of the day, Iran and its proxies are now well-entrenched in Iraq. They're well-entrenched in Syria. Their destabilizing activities in the region not only continue unabated, but if you spend time in the region, our allies there are more concerned than they have been in the past. And I would submit that much like our concern about the foreign terrorist fighters on the Sunni side, there are many foreign terrorist fighters, maybe not from as far away in most cases, on the other side of the spectrum. And they, too, are probably not having been radicalized based on this extremely nasty sectarian line. They're not likely to go back to being farmers and pharmacists. And that means that we're going to be dealing with what the intelligence and military communities often refer to as the Iran threat network for some time. We can talk more about that in the Q&A. I also want to second the issue that countering ISIL is critically important. I applaud and second everything that Brett said, but it is by no means, and I know he didn't mean to suggest it is, by no means the entirety of the terrorist threat. Al-Qaeda, not only ISIL may not be remaining and expanding, but I'd argue that Al-Qaeda actually is. And we just finished quite a large study, which is on our website, on Al-Qaeda in 2017 and beyond, and we think that this is something that we need to pay a whole lot of attention to. Al-Qaeda today is Al-Qaeda in Syria, but it also has provinces in the Sahel and elsewhere that show disturbingly promising resilience. But I'd like to bring this home for a moment, because the likelihood of all the successes that Brett laid out because of the tremendous effort that he and many others have invested means that while people can't go as easily, if at all, to Syria, by the way, both those people who are drawn to ISIL, and we haven't mentioned him, let me throw him out here, those who are still drawn to fighting Assad. I'm of the school that says it's great to counter ISIL, but if you leave Assad in power, we'll be dealing with this movie in sequels to come. They may not be able to go to Syria as easily, but they're not going to get less angry, and they're still going to get radicalized, and they're more likely to do things at home. I just came back from Brussels, and this was the only thing people there wanted to talk about. We don't talk about the returning foreign terrorist fighter issue as pressing an issue for us here in the United States, because it isn't. We have the number of officials publicly throw around is about 300 people who have gone or have even tried to go and either were failed or were foiled from going. But in Europe, of course, it's in the thousands. It includes families and children, and it's a much more pressing issue there. I'd argue that we have other variations of that issue here. First of all, in terms of the inspired. And second of all, and one that I won't spend a lot of time in, but I don't think people pay enough attention to, is in the next few years, the first few people who have been in jail, convicted of terrorism and terrorism-related offenses, are going to be released from prison. The first person, a woman actually, who spent time in jail convicted of ISIS-related infractions either is about to be or I think just was released from prison. And if you think that there are counter-radicalization CVE programs in our prisons, I've got some bridges to sell you in Brooklyn. If you think people are likely to become less radical in prison, wouldn't that be great? We don't have great, if any, CVE programs in terms of our probation system. And so that is going to be a different type of returning former fighter that we're going to have to deal with, of about 900 to 1,000 people. But the bigger issue, I think, is the inspired. And what we really need in this country is some really aggressive CVE, countering violent extremism, programs. Now, the programs that were thought up and were being put in place under the Obama administration were flawed. And I don't blame the Trump administration for being annoyed, for example, that the CVE grants, which were proposed by the Homeland Advisory Commission, which was populated by both Democrats and Republicans, and was a good idea, but those grants were only announced literally as the Obama administration was walking out the door. No administration wants to kind of inherit that type of a thing. I do think that the current administration has a ways to go. First of all, because their CVE review is still ongoing. And second of all, because the first taste that we've had of it is a rejiggering of the grants in two ways. One, it is only focused on what I would describe as Islamist extremists, and many in the administration, I think, improperly, my two cents, refer to as Islamic extremists. And I think there's a very important difference there. One refers to a religion and its adherents, and one to a political ideology. And dropped some very important groups that are working on countering neo-Nazi hate, etc. And I think we have a very sharp rise in very dangerous extremism from other types of isms in the far left and the far right that we also need to be countering. And the other way in which the changes to the grants gave me pause was that almost everything now has a component or it goes through law enforcement. And while and I'll just put it up here for the cameras one more time because otherwise my publisher at the Institute, thank you, please get that picture, will be very upset with me. What we recommend in our report, which is on our website, and is a bipartisan report, I might add, is that there has to be a connective tissue to law enforcement in these local networks throughout the country that are going to be focused on CVE. But at the end of the day, the people who are going to be most important in countering terrorism here in the homeland in the near term, in the medium term, are not going to be or only going to be agents and operatives and analysts, but are going to be clinical social workers, are going to be teachers, are going to be people in communities. And you cannot allow those relationships to be wholly securitized or people won't feel comfortable coming forward all the time. You want this to be done in such a way that people have a level of comfort and they will come forward. And you don't need to listen to Matt Levitt on this. Listen to law enforcement. Go talk to the FBI. Go talk to state and local police. We've had at least four major cases in Garland, in Orlando, in Boston, in New York, in New Jersey, where the FBI and others had investigated individuals, like in Orlando, Omar Mateen. And they ran it to ground and said there's actually nothing to charge this person with. A lot of strange behaviors are protected in our system, as well they should be. But it shouldn't be either we can prosecute you or nothing. There was no one for whom the FBI could hand this person off to clinical social workers or others saying, hey, this guy's got some really strange behaviors and is claiming affiliation with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and doesn't know the difference or care that these groups are literally fighting each other tooth and nail in the region. And now we know what happened. So we have to have a system in which people who are at risk for a variety of reasons, and in every case there'll be some element of grievance and some element of ideology. Those who say it's all ideology, they're wrong. There's always some type of grievance that creates a cognitive opening. And those who say it's only grievance are wrong, because you need something to mobilize you to violence, and that's some type of ideology. We need to be able to partner these elements together. So I think that there's a huge domestic component to this that needs a lot more attention. People in government now are still thinking about this long and hard, but I hope that at the end of the day, the solutions won't be only and entirely law enforcement. Law enforcement has an important role to play here. But if you put it all on them, at the end of the day, they legally won't be able to do it because the FBI doesn't want to be, and as former FBI can tell you, I wouldn't have wanted to be, thought police. That has to be done by someone else within the rule of law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. A lot of issues on the table. Thank you. Charles, I'll turn to you. A lot has been said. I'm sure you might want to comment on some of it or share your views on things that have been said. But on sort of the future of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, particularly in Syria? How do you see that dynamic? They've been competitors. Might they have some kind of rapprochement if one of them is losing ground? And also, if you'd zero in a bit on the situation in Idlib. Things have happened very much. Okay, Raqqa, there's a path there. Deir ez-Zor, maybe. Daraa and others, there's an agreement. Idlib is emerging as kind of a big hot zone and question mark. So your thoughts?
Sure. Please. Yeah, thanks, Paul. The Al-Qaeda issue, and I would agree with what's been said so far by other people on the panel, that Al-Qaeda for several years now, particularly in the Syria case, has been kind of undervalued, I think, at least in the public sphere, as an area of interest and importance. We had the brief period of the Khorasan group being a priority shortly after our aerial intervention in Syria. But really, apart from that, there's been very little focus on how Al-Qaeda has used Syria to evolve its modus operandi and has used it to no longer be necessarily the traditional cellular terrorist organization that we would have seen in 2001, but an army, as was said on the panel earlier. And I do really think from a policy perspective that we ought to have been paying more attention to it, and we definitely ought to be paying more attention to it now. And I'm sure that events in Idlib, which I'll go into in a minute, will probably necessitate that. But as Josh and I think Brett probably also know, I spent several years trying to big up the Al-Qaeda issue in the previous administration. And as I say, some attention was given to it, but it has really grown, and it has become a lot more, in my opinion, a lot more intelligent, a lot more smart. It's probably outplayed us on a policy level and has created a very very confusing, almost impossible challenge from a policy perspective. And I can come on to that if anyone's unclear what I mean in the Q&A session. But Al-Qaeda and ISIS have both really evolved in certain ways over the last few years. And what's happened in Syria and Iraq has really been the kind of core and the center catalyst for that evolution. Al-Qaeda, on a strategic level, began talking internationally in 2009 between themselves about the idea of shifting their brand away from AQI in Iraq. There was definitely an awareness, and this is common knowledge, that Al-Qaeda central leadership were writing letters to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq in 2006 saying, lay off the brutal violence. Stop killing so many Muslims in public places. Focus your attacks on military and government targets, not on markets. And all of those letters kind of went unheeded. But then in 2009 and 2010, we saw a very similar language being sent out to Al-Qaeda affiliates in places like Mali and Yemen. In the Malian case, the Associated Press seized a letter, fascinating, from the leader of AQIM to his commanders in Mali, in which he basically described the people of Mali as infants. He essentially said, the Malian people are babies. They don't understand what it means to live in a pure Islamic society. You can't march into their village and expect them to behave in a purist fashion from day one. So don't march into their village and chop off a thief's hand on day one, because what will happen? They will rebel against you, and our project and our investment will be lost. That advice to Mali failed. It was never really carried through. Similarly in Yemen, it was kind of adopted for some period of time, but the brutalism came out. But what's happened in Syria, in my opinion, from 2012 to 2015 or 16, was kind of the perfect implementation of that quote-unquote more pragmatic strategy. This wasn't a moderation of Al-Qaeda. This was an Al-Qaeda trying to be more intelligent and playing the long game. And in the Syrian case, up until very recently, it worked, but it's been forced to adapt to continue that success. So a lot of the rebrandings that Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria has undergone were largely as a result of having to continue to adapt this strategy. It discovered that, on one side, being pragmatic in Syria and trying to present yourself to Syrians as something different than AQI, something different than Al-Qaeda, who carried out 9/11, could only work up until a certain point. Al-Qaeda's brand was still bad. Syrians still ultimately distrusted a group who still openly identified as Al-Qaeda, so they rebranded. But then Al-Qaeda also discovered in Syria that its hardcore, truly, truly committed, truly most extremist element in Syria distrusted the idea of acting pragmatically. having done it for several years. And they began to say, you know, how much longer are we going to continue to ignore the Sharia? How much longer are we going to continue to allow all of these forbidden behaviors to continue within our midst? We can't justify this as true Muslims. And so Al-Qaeda's pragmatic modus operandi began to be challenged from both directions. And that, in 2016, last year, was really where we started to see this struggle for the identity of this new Al-Qaeda. And while all of this was happening, Al-Qaeda's central leadership in Afghanistan and Pakistan was appearing more and more distant from its affiliates. For my work in the Syrian case, I speak to many Syrians in the Al-Qaeda group and on its periphery, who frequently say that they go through all of these big debates within their Shura Council, and it takes 3 months for them to hear from Al-Qaeda's central leadership about whether or not a certain decision is legitimate or not. So in effect, you know, we've talked about the delegation of authority in the counter-ISIL coalition, but in a way we've seen an unconscious delegation of authority within Al-Qaeda to its affiliates. And because of that, they've decentralized. They've become more focused on local objectives. And as I've explained, that's had advantages but also disadvantages. So to take it up to where we are now in Idlib, what we've seen is really a reflection of having to continue to adapt to make that strategy work. And what I think we've really seen over the last several months is the people who have pushed the more pragmatic element of trying to gain trust in the Syrian population have been forced to listen to the most hardliners, who actually were directing a lot of the offensive operations that have just taken place against other opposition groups in Idlib, and to say, you know, now's the time to consolidate the influence that we have gained. Yes, this wasn't ultimately our objective. Our ultimate objective was to unify with all of the opposition, but that's failed. Now is the time to aggressively consolidate the achievements that we have made. And that's where we're starting to see some of the more old-style, aggressive Al-Qaeda come to the fore. And I think that's kind of a fascinating evolution which will continue to take place. But the reason why I've explained all of that is because it's very important to talk about the relationship with ISIS. And there's a debate in D.C., there's a debate in Europe these days about whether or not the demise of ISIS territorially might be an opportunity for Al-Qaeda to reacquire its former Iraqi affiliate and place it back under the Al-Qaeda fold. Now, as things are, the prospects for that, I would say, are still bad. There is so much bad blood between these two organizations. They have literally been fighting it out for years. Thousands of casualties between both sides just in Syria. But having said that, I think if Al-Qaeda's central leadership continues to be so distant from its affiliates, and particularly its affiliate in Syria and potentially its affiliate in Yemen, you may see on a local level Al-Qaeda affiliates being opportunistic and pulling in ISIS units who kind of feel lost. They don't have the same kind of grandeur. They don't have the same kind of powerful central leadership. They don't have the same kind of powerful brand that they had before. But I don't think that necessarily means an Al-Qaeda rapprochement with ISIS. But I do think it means Al-Qaeda being opportunistic and taking what it can get. The only but to that, and the last thing I'll say on this subject, is Hamza bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's son, appears to be being leveraged by Al-Qaeda's central leadership as kind of the new face of Al-Qaeda. He's young. He's well known for being Osama's favored son. He was the guy who he always brought along to different meetings. And his rhetoric, Hamza bin Laden's rhetoric in recent statements, does suggest that he is trying to position Al-Qaeda as the archetypal jihadi movement in the world. Again, having really taken a back step behind ISIS for the last few years. And Hamza has very purposefully, I think, not spoken out against ISIS in all of his recent statements. So whereas Ayman al-Zawahiri, the ultimate leader of Al-Qaeda, frequently calls ISIS all kinds of names, Hamza has barely even mentioned it. And for me, that could only potentially suggest not that he necessarily likes what ISIS has done, but that he does and might potentially see an opportunity to negotiate some kind of re-merger back under the Al-Qaeda fold. But having said all of that, I still think the chances for this are low because of the bad blood, because of the history over the last several years, and because when it comes push to shove, they do still have two fundamentally different models for operating. Mm-hmm. And they do ultimately have two different models of long-term objectives. And how you piece those back together again, I'm not quite sure.
Thank you very much, Charles. I'm going to pose a few questions to our panelists before turning it over to questions from the audience. Brett, let me start with a couple of questions to you. You described, obviously, the strategy to defeat and exterminate ISIS, I suppose, in Iraq and Syria. What have you gleaned from their strategy, given that they are losing territory and, I guess, you know, they're realistic about it? What do you think is their plan? Is it fight to the finish, or is there something clever up their sleeve? That's one question. The second is a political question, both sort of for Iraq and Syria. On the Iraqi side, what have you seen in terms of the Sunni, if you want, Arab-Sunni mood, Arab-Sunni politics? You know, there are some things which are recurring, destructions, difficult reconstruction, the central government is suspicious. Now you have PMU units, some of which are suspicious. But the Sunnis now have had experience with ISIS. And with your contact with them, have you seen new trends in Arab-Sunni politics in Iraq? How do they see their future, and what do they need most? A similar question on the Syrian side, it might particularly relate to Raqqa, which is, how do you see the governance of Raqqa after, take a few months, as you said, it might take a long time to liberate it. In Mosul, there is a government, such as it is, that's largely more or less accepted. How do you see it in Raqqa, their local council that you might want to bring back? Is there any role for the central government there? And within all of this, and maybe as relates to Iraq, because you did mention that the return of kind of a Saudi role, and you said that was quite an important thing, raises the question also of where Turkey is standing on the sort of the Sunni question in Iraq, and can they be helpful in stabilizing Iraq?
Thanks.
I know there are questions. But we only have you here.
ISIS.
So what's ISIS?
Okay,
thinking?
ISIS is thinking. It's interesting. As they lose more territory, sometimes I read in the commentary, ISIS always planned to lose all this territory. And I can tell you from all the information we get, they do not want to lose all this territory. They did not want to lose Mosul. They did everything they possibly could to hang on to Mosul. They did not want to lose Raqqa. Did they relocate some of their folks when the kind of writing became on the wall to some areas? Yes. They do not want to lose this territory. Their whole banner, what may have been this global phenomenon, was their main propaganda ploy was retain and expand the caliphate. We are a growing historic movement. It was in all of their propaganda. Most of their propaganda was not the beheadings and the gore. It was this come join this historic movement. It was actually this very positive image of this kind of appeal to nostalgia. They don't even put that in their propaganda anymore. So they did not want to lose their territory. So they are reeling. Their leader, Baghdadi, who claimed to be the caliph, and to be a caliph, you have to have some legitimacy, you protect your population, is deep underground in hiding. We assume he's alive, but we actually don't know. All he can do about every 6 months is release an audio tape. So this is an organization that is reeling. However, will they stick around? Will they morph? Yes. And I think Matt's comments are excellent. I actually agree with everything Matt said. And I think
I'm done.
what can we expect to see? And you know, we speak with some smart commentators quite frequently. This appeal, this ISIS appeal to nostalgia. So it's come join the historic caliphate. They're going to lose the caliphate. I think you'll start to see, this era of the lost caliphate, and that we had this glorious moment, and then all the crusaders came and took it away. That'll probably be what they try, and that's why we need to stay a step ahead of them to make clear the truth of what the caliphate was about. And that's why the counter-messaging campaigns of people who actually are rejecting ISIS, saw what it was like, is very important. Which plays into your second point on Iraq, Syria, Sunnis politics. I have to admit, just having dealing with this at so many levels in the region, from the strategic and meeting in capitals with heads of state to the tactical and meeting with IDPs and meeting with sheikhs who are joining the fight and everything else. Whenever I hear the Sunnis, I really bristle a little bit because there's no such thing. And there are many divisions, obviously, amongst the Sunnis. And This kind of grievance narrative is also something I bristle at, because the number one victim of ISIS are the Sunnis. I mean, ISIS came into Anbar province and basically massacred the Abu Nimer tribe back in 2014. They have massacred and killed any Sunni that disagreed with them. In 2013, you could see drip by drip, and I testified to this in 2013 before Congress, watching this coming from Syria, assassinating local leaders, assassinating sheikhs, all in the Sunni world. The Sunnis have totally, fundamentally rejected this movement. And there was a bit of a narrative in 2013 that, you know, a lot of us were waving the flag of ISIS very early, but it was, oh, this is a tribal revolution or something. It was ISIS. ISIS was in control of these events. And some Sunni movements, such as Naqshbandi and Ba'athist-affiliated movements, tried to ride the tiger of ISIS and have been completely wiped out, particularly up in Hawija. So the Sunnis have rejected ISIS fundamentally, and Sunnis are coming into the fold into the Iraqi state. And I give Prime Minister Abadi a great deal of credit on his devolution of power and empowering people at the local level, not to overlook the very serious problems that have been raised on the panel. And to get into those, I'd be here all day. But we are very attuned to all of those problems, particularly with the popular mobilization forces, which is a big topic. In Syria, same thing. The victim of ISIS were the Sunnis. The Shatat tribe in 2014, about 1,000 people massacred by ISIS right in the Euphrates Valley. Yet you still heard sometimes that this is a kind of a tribal revolution or this is an... It was ISIS. And it was ISIS taking control of Sunni areas and killing anyone that stood in their wake. And even in Syria, it is so much more complicated than just Sunni Alawite Kurd. You know, we have a lot of sources of information about who's where and who's what. But you can go to open sources. A very good piece came out from the Washington Institute back in 2015 about the demographics of Syria. And even back then, if you just looked at the demographics in 2015, living in regime-controlled areas, about 10 million people, and about 60% of them were Sunni. Living in opposition areas, only about 2 million people. Under ISIS at the time, about 2 million people. So, you know, the Sunnis in Syria writ large, a critical mass of the Sunnis, actually have not broken from the Syrian regime. That doesn't mean they like the Syrian regime. That doesn't mean they have any like, and they have a lot of hatred for Bashar al-Assad, and rightfully so. But they have not seen anything in terms of what would cause them to break from the regime. This is one reason I think we are seeing in the Syrian Democratic Forces a mass mobilization of Sunni Arabs coming under the umbrella of this force. This is happening. These are Sunni Arabs from the local area who do not like the regime but really hate ISIS and want to fight ISIS to get ISIS out. And one thing we hear from them also, they do not want the regime to return to their areas. So what happens after Raqqa? We have a Raqqa civilian council. These are local people. Most of these are not exiles. They stayed in Syria and lived through the horror of ISIS, and they are ready to go back into Raqqa and rebuild their town. They do not want the regime to come back into Raqqa. I mentioned the IDP flows because it's a very important data point. You know, we used to hear 6 months ago, well, you know, if you use the Syrian Democratic Forces to march in some of these areas, the population is actually going to join ISIS or fight with ISIS. That has totally not happened. In fact, the IDP flows are all fleeing, as I mentioned, north into the SDF lines. Contrary to that, where the regime is taking over territory, the IDPs are flowing into SDF lines. So I think a more stable model for defeating ISIS, we found, is the SDF than the regime, something I think Jennifer mentioned we very much agree with. So the point is, this is such a complicated mosaic. It is so complex. That's why I think we benefit from everyone in the think tanks and here at MEI about the very important work about what's happening on the ground, but it is so much more complex. In Idlib province, look, Idlib province is the largest al-Qaeda safe haven since 9/11, tied directly to Ayman al-Zawahiri. This is a huge problem. It's been a problem for some time. We have shown the spotlight, the international spotlight, on ISIS. We've been very focused on al-Qaeda in Idlib province. Leaders of al-Qaeda that make their way to Idlib province often do not make their way out of there. But we have to ask a question: why and how is Ayman al-Zawahiri's deputy finding his way to Idlib province? Why is this happening? How are they getting there? They're not paratroopers. So, and the approach, I obviously will not talk about anything the U.S. government has done in certain parts of Syria on this problem, but the approach by some of our partners to send in tens of thousands of tons of weapons and looking the other way as these foreign fighters come into Syria may not have been the best approach. And Al-Qaeda has taken full advantage of it. And Idlib now is a huge problem. It is an Al-Qaeda safe haven right on the border of Turkey. So that's something, obviously, we will be in very close discussions with the Turks on. And I think as we did in some ISIS areas in sealing the border, making sure nobody can cross, is something we might have to think about in Idlib province. Because it's a huge problem. It's a different problem than ISIS, but it is a big problem and something we have to very much focus on as a counterterrorism objective.
Thank you, Brett. We have about 20, 25 minutes left, so I'm going to go to the audience. I'll start with the lady in the back. We'll take three or four questions each. Lady in pink. Keep your hand up so a microphone comes to you. Now you need to take my microphone. All right. Maybe you can start your question to save time.
For Mr. McGurk, but to all other members of the panelists.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, hi, I'm Christina. I'm from Code Pink. So my question is directed to Mr. McGurk and other members of the panel who praise the efficiency of our tactics in Syria and Iraq. And I want to say that there are reports stating that over 1,000 civilian casualties have been killed in Syria and in Iraq since the start of the Trump presidency. So I would like to know if you view these civilian casualties by drones as counterproductive to our counterterrorism measures?
Thank you.
Thank you.
The lady in the front, who I believe is my boss, Ambassador Jenkins. It's coming.
Thank you very much. This has been a really excellent panel. My question is for Matt Levitt so he won't run off. I, too, like everything you said about CBE, but I have a question. Maybe this is a naive question. But if social workers and school counselors and neighbors and mosque imams begin to work with the inspired who have not yet committed a crime, as you suggest, isn't there a jeopardy for them? Isn't there the Patriot Act and material support, or isn't there a nervousness that if they're are worried about somebody and they don't go to law enforcement, as you suggest and as I agree with, couldn't they be in trouble later on if that person flips and does something nasty?
Thank you. Right behind you, since that'll be quick.
Hello, thank you all for coming. My name is Jesse March with the Stimson Center. My question for Mr. McGurk, for Jennifer and Charles, regarding ISIS's presence in the southwestern safe zone in Daraa, do we see the chance that the fight against ISIS will spread to southern Syria to address that issue? And also, Jennifer, for your statement about Daraa, can you kind of touch further on the growing presence of HTS in Daraa?
Thank you. Gentleman in the second row in the gray suit.
Thank you very much. Patrick Tucker with Defense One. Question for Mr. McGurk. Some senior Pentagon leaders that I've spoken to have echoed Ms. Caffarella's concerns. Specifically, their concern is that Iranian forces and Russian forces are going to use the ceasefire to consolidate gains in Syria, which may threaten coalition forces in the future. So, three-part question. Number one, do you see that happening? Number two, if it is happening, is it acceptable? And number three, if it's not acceptable, what can be done to change it?
Thank you. Right behind you.
So, I'm with the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. So, given President Trump's strategy or lack thereof in Syria, how is that going to lead to an increase in terrorism and sectarian violence from Shia that are backed by Iran and Sunnis, whether it be Al-Qaeda or ISIS affiliates?
Thank you. Matt, let's start with you.
Okay. First of all, Ambassador, thank you for your question. And we get into this in great detail in the report because there's lots of legitimate reasons why people are concerned, people who want to be involved in this work, that they could run afoul of material support statutes if things aren't made clear. We actually, in our bipartisan study, came to the conclusion that that clarity just needs to be shared with them, that it is there. That people who are working in this field, especially before people are crossing the legal threshold into illegal activity, There is plenty of space in which people can operate without having to have those types of concerns. But that's part of the reason why we also argue that there needs to be connective tissue with law enforcement so that you can have this conversation. Let's be honest, for example, there have been cases where the FBI is running an investigation, a counterterrorism investigation into somebody. It's not done yet. And they've said this person should simultaneously be getting some type of counseling. We may end up indicting this guy. We may not. But in the meantime, this person should get some counseling. And so those people who are doing that should be made aware that there's something else going on. They won't be given all the details, but they also need to be given some type of confidence. There's also the concern of some type of insurance. So we interviewed people who are active in communities who said, listen, what happens if I work with someone and I'm tremendously successful and we off-ramp someone and they don't end up becoming radical? These are not strictly linear situations. These go up and down. People get angry, they get less angry. Let's say that we defeat ISIS and Assad becomes an even bigger problem and people get radicalized again or something happens in this individual's life. And that later on, God forbid, 5-10 years from now, they do something. Could I be sued by a family of a victim because I worked with them 10 years earlier? And the answer is that's something, there are actually efforts already to address those types of concerns. So your question is very much on point, but not to the extent that it should thwart us from doing the type of smart programming that should be done to build a cohesive society. It does have obvious counterterrorism implications. But the larger reason to do this is because we as a society should be working against gangs, against left and right wing extremism, against religious extremism. When kids, youth, others are at risk, we should have systems in place as a society to deal with that. And if we do, kind of in a public health model at the most basic level, we'll be trying to help society be able to push off these things and protect our youth in the early stages. So in a short answer, I can't get into all the details, but you will find them here.
Again. Thank you, ma'am. That's Jennifer.
Sure, absolutely. So to address specifically the question about Al-Qaeda in Daraa, Al-Qaeda actually has been present in Daraa since the beginning of the revolution, of course, when Al-Qaeda deployed. The Daraa became less of a priority in terms of resourcing for Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and its predecessors, only because, of course, the real fight against the regime and its external backers shifted to northern Syria. However, we saw earlier this year in late May, if I'm not mistaken on the time frame, a deployment of a set of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham military, administrative, and religious leaders down to Daraa, which to me is actually the signal that having consolidated largely, even before the most recent developments at Idlib, Al-Qaeda had already largely consolidated its dominance in that province and had shifted its main efforts south, likely in anticipation of exactly the U.S.-Russian deal that we now have. My concern with that deal would take me some time, so I won't go into all of it, but of course there is no mechanism currently to enforce the deal that I understand, at least, and it's unclear to me how actually aligning with the Russians will enable us to defeat Al-Qaeda or ISIS in the south, both of which gain credibility by fighting against Bashar al-Assad and his backers. So that's Daraa.
I'll take the good questions in order. First question on civilian casualties, I would just say it's a war. This is a war, number one. This is the most precise air campaign in history. We've never seen anything like it. Our standards of airstrikes are extraordinarily high. I've seen how this procedure works in practice. I mentioned the changes we've made under the Trump administration. One thing we have not changed is the standard, our very high standard before we clear an airstrike. What has changed is the urban nature of the combat as we get into the real core havens of ISIS in places like Mosul and Raqqa. But obviously we don't want to see any civilian casualties, but our standards have not changed. There's a question about the ISIS affiliate in the southwest. There's a very persistent, small, but ISIS affiliate in the southwest. It's called Jaish Khalid bin Walid. It's on the border of the Golan and Jordan. It's a concern of ours. We actually just redesignated them because they changed their name, so we did a redesignation last week, and we will be increasingly focused on that problem. They are increasingly severed from ISIS in Raqqa and these other areas, which we've also been working on. Question about threats to coalition forces based on the Russia. I would just say one thing. I mean, Josh touched on this, and Jennifer's absolutely right. I think we've demonstrated one thing in the last 3 months, 2 months. Any threat to our forces will be met with a fairly devastating response. So I think that message has been received. And where we have deconfliction arrangements, we'll obviously enforce those arrangements. That's what those arrangements are for. So I think we're fairly confident that the arrangements we're getting in place now, some of these deconfliction arrangements can actually hold. But obviously, we'll do all we need to do to protect our forces. And that is an ongoing conversation with the Russians. This is deconfliction. It's not coordination, cooperation. It's two different things. But we have multiple communications with them, military to military, every day, helping to resolve problems. It's actually working quite effectively on the ground.
Thank you. Josh and Charles, any comments?
Yeah. Maybe to hit on the first two questions briefly. In terms of the fundamental question, is killing non-combatants counterproductive for counterterrorism? The answer is yes. I mean, counterterrorism is an exercise in trying to prevent non-combatant deaths and to be the legitimate actor rather than the illegitimate one whose violence is able to rally a global coalition against it in the hands of folks like Brett and his team. So I think you're right to call our attention back to that. What's not clear to me from the outside is how much this is in some ways the flip side of the delegation issue that Brett hit on earlier. Standards are a piece of how one tries to ensure the avoidance of non-combatant casualties, even in a very, very difficult war that is moving increasingly to urban centers. But who makes the call and how many folks put eyes on a potential target before that call can be part of it, too. It's the standard and the who's applying that standard. And I don't have a great sense from the outside whether some of what are apparently changes in where calls get made have contributed to what are at least seemingly escalating reports of that. But it's an issue to watch because fundamentally I agree with your premise. In terms of the question about how to stop short of a moment in which law enforcement takes over counter-radicalization and instead have other forms of intervention, agree very much with Matt's good comments. All I would add is in a structural sense, how we went about this was in part was through development of a task force that was rolled out in January of 2016, the CVE task force, designed to bring together the work that at that point was admittedly fairly disparate across the U.S. government, and to put all of those who work on CVE in one place, with one leadership, consolidating their efforts, not just to get it right within the government, but also to be a place that could clarify. Because I agree with Matt, it's more a matter of clarifying so that people understand what they can do rather than actually changing any standards or laws. And that task force had a hard job, but I think was beginning to make some serious progress at being a place to plug in for outside actors, whether local law enforcement, those outside government, community leaders, whatever. And it's not clear to me where that has gone in the past 6 months. I think in some ways some of the wrangling over the grants issue that was mentioned earlier and even what to call, what we at least called CVE, may have been something of a distraction from what struck me as a trajectory that overall could offer the important clarification that your question points to.
Thank you for the discussion. Charles?
I'll touch on a few of the questions, but as briefly as possible. And I first wanted to just answer a question which I think Brett threw out into the room, which was how did Al-Qaeda's deputy leader get his way all the way to Syria? Well, he...
Closer to the microphone.
Closer or...
Closer.
Okay. It seemed to be squeaking when I was close, but how did he get there? Well, he was released by Iran in a hostage swap, and it's I think fairly common knowledge in the counterterrorism community that Al-Qaeda basically made a deal with the Iranian government after 9/11 that in exchange for the protection, somewhat in house arrest, of many of Al-Qaeda's most senior leaders and Osama bin Laden's family, then in exchange Al-Qaeda would not attack Iran. Well, Iran has also been willing to release senior Al-Qaeda leaders when it has had a need to do so, and in this case it was part of a hostage swap with an Iranian diplomat who'd been kidnapped in Yemen. The appearance of Abu al-Khair al-Masri in Syria was a pretty big deal, but it was also a pretty big statement of where Iran stands on counterterrorism. Very, really, really briefly, ISIS in southern Syria, I don't necessarily give all that much of a great potential for their future. I know it's something that the Jordanians are particularly closely watching these days, and I'm sure the US as a close partner. I think, as Jenny said or intimated, the Al-Qaeda issue in the south is probably something that would be of more interest to me. Certainly for, I think, the first time in 2 years, Al-Qaeda has senior leadership figures in southern Syria, and I think Jenny was right, since May. And all of those were pulled up to northern Syria in 2015 because that was chosen as the area of focus. Now that we have these de-escalation zone agreements, this is an opportunity for Al-Qaeda to try to leverage disenfranchised members of the opposition who basically refuse to accept what is in effect a slow surrender. The de-escalation zone agreements pushed by Russia are founded upon the idea of stopping conflict in Syria, stop the fight against the regime, it's over. That plus the announcement via Twitter and leaks via the media that the Trump administration has closed down assistance to the moderate opposition fighting the Assad regime, plus the shape and the perception of the de-escalation zone agreements amongst some portions of the opposition across Syria, but in this case in the south, could potentially play into Al-Qaeda's hands. And the one thing I would add to this is the interesting thing about the people who were sent to the south is that they were some of the hardline, most hardline wing of Al-Qaeda's presence in Syria, who were originally in the south but who found themselves isolated and who have now been sent back, presumably because they now see an opening. And I think that just by itself is quite interesting, particularly because it's been some southern tribes whose tribes are embedded within the southern front of the Free Syrian Army who have been so restless for the last 18 months or so about having to continue to abide by ceasefires, cessations of hostilities, local ceasefires, and now a de-escalation zone agreement. So I'm not saying this is an Al-Qaeda victory or will be, but it's an opportunity for them, and I think that's where we are. The last thing I would say, in terms of the last question, I think, about the Trump administration's strategy and whether or not that kind of provides openings for terrorist groups. I mean, my only way of... to be honest, I don't know whether we can really say there is a different Trump administration strategy than what came before it. I think there's been a lot more continuation than there has been change. But in effect, what was set up by the previous administration is now being pursued, is being shown by things like the de-escalation zone agreement, which is that we never really had that much faith in the opposition's fight against the regime. We never really were committed enough to do what was necessary if we really were to stand by our original statements in 2011, which was that Assad had to go. We never really followed through on that early statement 6 years ago. And so now we are in a situation where we're negotiating agreements with certain international and regional actors, which in effect are telling the opposition to surrender and accept that they've lost. Now that might very well be a statement of fact, but for Syrians on the ground, they always have an alternative avenue to pursue, and that is the kind of groups who aren't party to these de-escalation zone agreements. And I think that's the big danger for us, is that, as I said about the south, it does provide an opportunity for more extremist groups to say, we've been here with you from the very start. We've never committed aggressions against you, and in the south, that's largely true. We are now your only channel of continuing a fight against the Assad regime. And we, when we're talking about Al-Qaeda, do have sources of revenue and external income to fund some of that conflict. And I think that's something that we do really need to be concerned about. And to sum up, that's what the problem I have with our whole Syria policy is, it, in my opinion, is still short-termist. We are still reacting to events and treating symptoms of a crisis, whilst the fundamental root causes are still in existence. And not only are they still in existence, but we're effectively implementing a strategy now that accepts that they will remain for good. So terrorism from Syria is going to be around, emanating from Syria is going to be around for a while.
Thank you, Chaz. I have time for two more questions, one from the right side, one from the left side. The gentleman in the fifth row, yes, with his hand up. Keep your gentleman, keep your hand up so the microphone can reach you. Thank you. There you go.
Hi, my name is Ann Rutherford. I had a question about what's caused the Iraqi crisis in the first place, the Shiite militias that were terrorizing the Sunni population. What has been done in the government to abate that, and how much resentment is going to be in Iraq from a government that took years to respond to this crisis?
Thank you. Question from, that's hard to choose, the young man right there.
Hi, I'm Michael Greco, and I'm a student at GW. I remember reading that ISIS fighters from abroad are easily radicalized, but just as easily de-radicalized. So I was wondering what is the difference, or is there any change from Obama's policy on de-radicalization in the Trump administration?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you all. I'm going to add one question myself. This week, Hezbollah in Lebanon defeated the Al-Qaeda affiliate in some of the hills there, and the Lebanese army, which is coordinating a little bit with Hezbollah, which has good relations with the U.S., might move against some ISIS fighters that will be the last pockets in Lebanon. Do you, Brett, have any comment on that, or does anybody have any comment on that? Those were two quick questions. Going down quickly down the line, our time is almost up. Anything to say?
Sure. It is not the case that people are as easily de-radicalized as they are radicalized. If only it were so. What we do know for a fact is that every case is going to be different. Not everybody who's coming back from Syria and Iraq is coming back as a terrorist. Not everybody is going to be as dangerous. But under the category better you than me, I'm glad I'm not that, say, European, say, Belgian police or counterterrorism official who has to interview each and every one of these people that comes back, and they do, and they, I was just meeting with them a couple of weeks ago, they meet with them again and again and again to determine, yeah, I'm pretty sure that you're not posing a threat right now. It's actually very, very, very complicated, and more so because you have entire families. What happens with children who've grown up in these horrific circumstances where the kind of thresholds of behavior that we have in most of the world are gone, where brutality is the norm and lack of education, and how do you deal with children that are that scarred even if they don't know they are? This is a tremendous, tremendous problem. It is not easy at all, and I would only echo the foundations of the question. I think that what we have done in Iraq, and Brett described in detail, is amazing. I am not yet in a position to have confidence that we won't be seeing a rerun of this movie. I'm not yet convinced that the Iraqi government will fully be able to put in place the kind of political reforms that will give the Sunni minority the kind of stake in the government, or even just a sense of security that will not push them into the arms of more radical groups again.
Thank you, Matt.
Two very quick comments. The first is, you didn't ask, but Al-Qaeda de-radicalization, actually, I do think also needs to be talked about, because among the ways that Al-Qaeda recruits is actually first and foremost based on a profound sense of injustice, not first and foremost ideology. So I've spoken to CVE folks, for example, in Europe that actually have a harder time countering the Al-Qaeda recruiter who is saying, look at Bashar al-Assad's war crimes, look at Russia's war crimes, the U.S. is aligning with them, you know, join the Al-Qaeda fight. So that's a real big problem for the future. A second, I would just echo Matt's comments on the Iraqi side, and I do think actually the current crisis or the current issue on the table, which is the reports of extrajudicial killings of Sunni civilians and just civilians more broadly in ISIS-held areas, is a very important case for whether the Iraqi government actually will take action to investigate those crimes and to hold those accountable. I believe that Prime Minister Abadi has his heart in the right place when it comes to protecting the civilian population. Whether he actually has the capability to do that is an open question, and I think that will be an indicator of what's to come after the U.S. does shift.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm going to jump to Charles and Josh and give Brett the last word. Charles, any comments?
Really briefly. I mean, the Assad situation, I think, is interesting. The only real thing I would say, I mean, this is a significant development for Lebanon. The perception and or this presentation of this as being a Hezbollah victory against extremism and against potential threats to Lebanese stability might, as we were talking about earlier today, mm-hmm. present Hezbollah with the first opportunity in years to have some kind of not just Shia popularity in Lebanon, but nationwide popularity. So we have now defeated the presence of ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates on Lebanese soil. We have now shored up the border with Lebanon, and we've done this for Lebanon. And I think that may or may not prove to be quite a significant development for Hezbollah in the Lebanese context. The PMUs, you know, ISIS, as we've said along the panel, have committed so many atrocities that you can't even count. And on a scale that we haven't seen in a very long time. So nothing that the PMUs have done can ever really compare to what ISIS has done in Iraq. But the one counter to that is that, as many of us will all know, as people who've worked in and around the Middle East, that's not always necessarily the most important thing. Scale doesn't always necessarily always reflect in perception. And so the fact that there was one incident in Mosul where Shia militiamen were throwing Sunni men off a cliff and then riddling their bodies with machine gun fire, and then the video of that went viral on the internet, could have just enough of a mobilizing effect amongst some people who might be vulnerable to ISIS's ideology, just as much as ISIS's killings of 5,000 Sunni men in Deir ez-Zor in Syria in 2014 turned Sunnis off of the ISIS ideology. So scale isn't always necessarily the most important determinant of that measure. And so for exactly that reason, it is important that people like Prime Minister Abadi come out and say very clearly that these acts do not represent what we do, and we have to, as the United States, do all that we can to prevent those kind of acts. Because one video can have an enormous effect. It's not going to mobilize 5 million Iraqi Sunnis to join ISIS, but if it mobilizes 100, that's 100 more guys that we have to face on the battlefield. So that's, you know, that's something that we do need to be concerned about now as we're winning.
Thank you, Charles. Josh?
Just a word on the interesting de-radicalization question. I would echo Matt and Jennifer. The de-radicalization is generally quite hard. I think in some ways we may have a skewed sample set so far. That is, to the extent there are folks who are returning at this stage with the conflict still boiling, it may be some folks who have in fact become some folks disillusioned, et cetera. And so it's skewed. It makes it look a little easier than it is for the hardened folks, and of course the folks who are coming back with ill intent, whom we, you know, don't know about sometimes till too late. I would even say that de-radicalization of folks who haven't been immersed in a landscape like Syria and Iraq, but simply have become radicalized here in the United States, that's hard enough. And we have interesting orders from a federal judge in Minnesota over the past year or so, actually trying to get a sense of whether de-radicalization programs work by mandating that certain defendants, as part of their plea bargain, go through them and then get a report to the court of whether this seems to be working. So it'll be interesting to see the results of that, but that's in the U.S. Imagine what radicalization is like when you're immersed in this as the landscape of Syria as it is right now.
Thank you, Josh. Britt?
I think I'd just say first thank you to MEI for the panel, and thank you, Wendy. This is I really welcome the opportunity. I think it's been a very good discussion. A lot is still on the table, so it's very hard for me to even open up some of these issues in 30 seconds. I would just say, look, the government of Iraq has a policy to bring all armed groups under its control. It has to act and implement that policy, and obviously we'll do what we can to help. A place like Iraq will have problems for the rest of our lifetimes. This is a very difficult part of the world. I think it's our objective to make sure that these problems are not the types of problems that are transnational that can affect our own national security. We need to stay engaged and obviously help them. But in terms of the scale of what we saw in 2014, what really fueled ISIS, sometimes I'm at, what about ISIS 2.0? ISIS was fueled by these foreign fighters who poured into Syria. You started to see in 2013, 2014, suicide bombers, nearly all of whom are foreign fighters, ticking up to almost 60 a month. And when you have suicide bombers attacking, and they were attacking children's soccer games and ice cream parlors and marketplaces, everything else, that will rip a society apart. And these were primarily the foreign fighters coming from all around the world. We have managed to cut down on that significantly, and we need to continue to keep the pressure on. So I think what we saw in 2014, we have really mitigated the risk of seeing something like that again, but obviously we need to stay engaged. So a lot more to discuss, and I look forward to joining you again here sometime. Thank you.
Thank you again, Brett, for taking the time to be with us. Thank you, all of our panelists, for being with us today. Thank you to the audience.